Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It all happened just the way any good central banker would want it to, nice and easy. For all the speculation about rate cuts, there were no surprises from our friends over at the Federal Reserve today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 7th of August. Good to have you here. The Federal Open Market Committee, that's Mr. Bernanke and his closest friends, of course, they held interest rates steady at 5.25%. But as is usually the case of late, everybody was more interested in what Bernanke et al. Had to say rather than what they actually did. Here's Marketplace's Amy Scott.
Investors knew better than to hope for an interest rate cut, but they wanted a little recognition of what they've been going through. In its statement this afternoon, the Fed did acknowledge that financial markets have been volatile, that consumers and businesses are having a harder time getting credit, and that the housing correction isn't over yet. Still, the Fed is clearly more concerned about inflation than weakness in the economy. Roger Kubarich is chief U.S. economist at UniCredit Global Research.
I'd say that they are hinting that the next move is up, but they won't be raising rates until, first, the housing market stabilizes, and second, the credit market stabilizes, and that may not be until next year.
The Fed may get some help from its pals in the private sector. Reports surfaced yesterday that mortgage finance company Fannie Mae wants regulators to let it buy more mortgages. Charles Lieberman is chief financial officer with Advisors Capital Management. He says that could be enough to get money moving again, not just in real estate, but throughout the financial markets.
If Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac can relieve some of the illiquidity in the marketplace without the Fed intervening, that really helps the Fed enormously.
The Labor Department released numbers today that supported the Fed's inflation worries. Labor costs jumped more than they had in 7 years, and worker productivity, a measure of what employers get for their money, grew more slowly than expected. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Nowhere in the Fed statement this afternoon was there any hint of doing anything about the shakiness in the economy to keep it contained, as Mr. Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson have been talking about the past couple of weeks. We got Greg McBride from Bankrate.com on the line to chat about that. Greg, were you surprised by the Fed statement?
No, I mean, I think what they're doing is, basically it's, daddy telling the teenager, yeah, I hear you, but, your problems aren't as big as you think they are kind of thing. The reality of it is it's not something that's impacting all households. It's only impacting some households and businesses, albeit I think some more than the Fed would really like to see. It's perhaps not as contained as they had hoped or expected just a couple of weeks ago.
All right, well, let's look at some of those examples of, not being contained. There is the volatility in the market. We've got all kinds of deals, big deals on Wall Street being pushed back. Investment banks are going to lose some money because some of these deals aren't happening. I mean, there's a wider leakage thing happening here, don't you think?
Well, I think the best example of that is what we're seeing in the jumbo mortgage market. What's happened over the last week or so in the jumbo mortgage market is that borrowers that are taking out more money than the $417,000 threshold that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac usually use to buy mortgages are having to pay higher rates. And why is that? Because investors are suddenly accounting for risk or even the perception of risk. And as soon as cooler heads prevail among investors, they'll realize that it's just there's not a good basis to be marking those rates up as high as they are for borrowers that have demonstrated and continue to perform admirably with very good credit quality and timely payments.
No pressure here, Greg, but investors are not known for having cooler heads.
Well, we've seen a lot of that evidenced in the stock market lately with the wild ups and downs. But, you know, again, I think a lot of this is characteristic with a transitioning economy, sort of the uncertain landscape as it pertains to the housing market and just what the Fed, what tack the Fed is going to take in the months to come.
Pull it back for me for a second and look at some of the bigger issues that have gotten a lot of the press. Bear Stearns and the trouble it's been having with some of its hedge funds, American Home Mortgage, those sorts of things.
Well, you know, I think a lot of this is you live by the sword, you die by the sword. You know, a lot of lenders weren't as stringent as some of their competitors. A lot of investors weren't as vigilant about risk as some of their competitors. And that's really what you're starting to see is that risk is now starting to bite back, and it's those that were out on the edge of the diving board, but their tippy toes over the edge that are, you know, they're most likely to fall into the pool at this point.
On the topic of risk, actually, how much risk do you think the Fed is taking here? As when it says, as it did today, in essence, caveat emptor, you know, you guys look out for yourselves.
The Fed's not going to come right out and say this, but they do not want to be in the position of winning the battle of economic growth, but losing the war of inflation. And right now, their primary focus is what they call price stability, what you and I call inflation. They're focused on keeping inflation low. And if they do that, that bodes well for the economy over the long term, even if we do have some short-term bumps in the road.
Greg McBride at Bankrate.com. He's a senior financial analyst there. Greg, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Kai.
Wall Street took its sweet time figuring out what to make of the Fed meeting. It all ended happily, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Kevin Martin doesn't have quite the name recognition of that guy who runs the Federal Reserve, but he's in charge of a pretty important group of his own. He's the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. Martin gave a speech today in Baltimore, Maryland. The Association of Public Safety Communications Officials is having its annual meeting there, and Martin gave them an update on the status of something that's been keeping everybody in their line of work pretty busy, a massive retooling of the emergency radio network. Marketplace's Lisa Napoli has more.
Everyone who's used a mobile or cordless phone has had the problem. Interrupted service of some sort or another. It's a nuisance for you, but it's been a bane of the emergency service workers' existence for a few years now.
I've talked to cops who are out in the beat, and they were pulling over a suspect who was wanted for any number of crimes, and all of a sudden their radio just cut out, and they couldn't get back in touch with their base.
That's Corey Bowles of Dow Jones Newswire. He's been covering the problem and what's being done to fix it by the company causing the biggest bandwidth bleed over, Sprint Nextel. They and the FCC agreed a couple years ago that the cell phone provider would spend $5 billion to straighten things out. The work has been underway for a couple of years now, but Alan Caldwell of the International Association of Fire Chiefs says,
we have not made as much progress as we had originally anticipated.
Everyone knew it would be a big project, but just how big has been confounding.
Well, I've often compared this effort to having to redesign the wings of the airplane while it's still flying.
Steve Proctor is with the Utah Communications Agency Network.
You have to touch every repeater, every handheld portable radio, or every mobile radio in order to retune those radios.
That's millions of them across the country. Earlier this summer, Commissioner Martin nudged the parties involved to pick up the pace, and if they don't, he could soon step in and force them to. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
We've got another 4 years until Civil War buffs get to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the beginning of that war with special reenactments of Fort Sumter and what have you. But states that were in the thick of the fighting are planning now to cash in on what they hope will be a boom in tourism then. From Nashville, Tennessee, Blake Farmer reports.
Standing on the veranda of the Carnton Plantation just south of Nashville, Civil War historian Eric Jacobson explains the home's role in the Battle of Franklin on November 30, 1864.
This area was just blistered with artillery fire, but the wounded began to arrive here at about dark.
This was a Confederate hospital. The amputated limbs were said to be piled as high as the smokehouse. Four generals lay dead on the back porch after the fighting. All in all, 9,200 soldiers died that day, considered a Union victory. The 2,500 people who lived here back then attempted to forget that battle, refusing congressional offers for any kind of commemoration. Jacobson says even the people who lived here at Carnton tried to remove most signs of the battle, including the blood stains.
They were removed, unfortunately, by 20th century occupants. The bloodstains were sanded out of the floorboards.
Walking along the perimeter of the plantation, Jacobson reaches down for a recent artifact.
Oh, there's a golf ball. Isn't that funny?
The past was so completely forgotten here that what's practically the backyard of the Carnton Plantation was turned into the back nine of a golf course. But now Franklin is trying harder to remember its history. The city and several preservation groups have purchased the golf course for $5 million, hoping to turn it into a battlefield park and big tourist draw. Communities throughout the Southeast are making improvements to Civil War sites. They're preparing for a projected influx in tourists during the 150th anniversary of the Civil War. States are jumping on the bandwagon, too, with their own anniversary commissions, says Civil War Preservation Trust spokesman Jim Campy.
Pennsylvania has started a commission, Virginia, Tennessee, Georgia.
And now the dollars are starting to flow. The state of Tennessee chipped in $1 million to help finish paying for that golf course property in Franklin. Georgia is looking to build a Civil War visitor center. Pennsylvania's Gettysburg is getting a new museum. Groups in Maryland and Virginia are working up marketing campaigns for their historic sites. Carol Summers says they're all after a specific group of sightseers called heritage tourists. Summers is a tourism consultant in Charlotte, North Carolina.
In the past 10 years, the heritage tourist has really become kind of the darling of the tourism industry. They are traveling to visit historic sites, and they spend more money, they stay longer.
Heritage tourists spend $620 per trip, compared with $450 for a beach vacationer. That's according to a 2003 study by the Travel Industry Association. The number of wandering history buffs is growing, too. The association says heritage tourism is up 13% from 1996. Campy of the Civil War Preservation Trust says economic forces are driving a new wave of battlefield preservation. He adds that neglected battlefield sites need to capitalize on the interest because if they wait, developers will likely beat them to the punch.
I would argue in places like Middle Tennessee, Central Virginia, around Atlanta, that we have 5 years at the outside, and in most of those areas, maybe only two or three. Places are getting swallowed up.
Campy's pitch to the business world, as battlefields leave, so do the tourists. The message has certainly gotten through back in Tennessee. The town of Franklin has attracted the attention of the National Park Service, which is considering the battlefield site for a military park. With help from the National Park's logo, town leaders expect the number of visitors to jump from 40,000 per year to more than 200,000 in Nashville. I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
You can check our website for more about Civil War tourism. It's marketplace.org.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We asked you for your letters, and we got them. Our story about highly skilled immigrants not turning their H-1B visas into green cards much anymore got some attention, especially the observation that many of those engineers and scientists get valuable on-the-job training here and then move, along with their skills, back overseas. George Scalise listens to the program. He is also the president of the Semiconductor Industry Association. That's the main lobbying group for the computer chip industry, which in turn is a heavy user of H-1B workers.
For U.S. semiconductor manufacturers, H-1B visa and employment-based green card programs are vital to the industry's continued success. With about two-thirds of U.S. electrical engineering PhDs going to foreign nationals, U.S. employers must be able to hire and retain this talent.
The consumer product story of the past couple of weeks has been toys, specifically toys from China coated with lead paint. Mattel's subsidiary Fisher-Price wound up recalling almost a million Elmos and Big Birds. Victoria Moss of Portland, Oregon, wrote to say that the hurt that recall will put on Mattel's bottom line is a logical consequence of outsourcing.
So Mattel has to pay $30 million to recall the lead-tainted toys. That's still less than what they would have to invest to produce their merchandise here in the United States, employing our citizens with family wage jobs.
We count on rafts of letters after some of our commentators have their say, and David Frum didn't disappoint last week. David took issue with congressional plans to expand the state children's health insurance program, SCHIP, it's called. Congress has since passed the bill. The president has said he's going to veto it. But David's point was that many of the kids covered under SCHIP double dip. That is, they're covered by private insurers as well. Pediatrician Danielle Kasher from Philadelphia says not so.
I have yet to see a family who has CHIP insurance also have additional coverage. Many of the families that come to my practice would fall through the cracks without CHIP.
As the Wall Street Journal teetered on the auction block, journalism professor Neil Henry lamented the fate of the newspaper business. Its ads, he said, are being siphoned off by the Internet, by companies like Google that use newspaper content to drive their own businesses. The model is what's known as a news aggregator, and one of the more successful aggregators is FARC.com. Drew Curtis runs it, and he says, don't blame the web.
Turns out advertising in newspapers isn't effective as ad sales marketers would have you believe. I was told back in the mid-90s that the response rate on a newspaper ad was 4% of circulation. Turns out on the Internet we can measure that. It's actually 0.2% of all traffic.
Send your web traffic our way. The address is marketplace.org, and leave us your comments while you're there. Just click on the link that says contact. Coming up, to you and me, it's pasta. To an Italian,
it's a commodity product. It's like gold or like petrol, you know.
But first, let's do the numbers. A seesaw day today. The Dow Industrials wound up climbing 35 points, a quarter of 1%, to close at 13,504. The NASDAQ rose 14 points, more than a half percent, to finish at 2561. The S&P 500 was up as well, 9 points, about 6-tenths percent, to end at 1476. Bear Stearns rose more than 3% today. The Financial Times said the brokerage's CEO has been reassuring other financial bosses about the firm's underlying strength. Citigroup slicked up half a percent, but Luminant Mortgage Capital dimmed 75%. The home loan investment firm said it was hit by a lot of margin calls. That is, the secondary mortgage market is tightening. Still on Wall Street, the New York Mercantile Exchange marched up more than 5%. The New York Post reported NYMEX is about to be sold to a rival exchange. The casino company Wynn Resorts rolled up 10% after it announced profits of nearly $90 million in the second quarter. Overseas markets rose. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and AngiesList.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale trade for June. The Airline Pilots Association holds their annual Air Safety and Security Forum. Topics for discussion include implications of going green and safety in the cockpit. And the Million Dollar Mermaid celebrates her birthday tomorrow. Various sources cite swimmer and movie star Esther Williams' age will be 84, 85, or 86. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know a company's in trouble when the CEO says there's a gap between the share price and where he thinks the company ought to be valued. Today's case in point is Warner Music. The record label posted a greater-than-expected quarterly loss today. Shares promptly fell more than 10%. The reprise is a variation on the digital blues. Customers are downloading their music, not buying CDs. But Warner is at least trying to fight back. Ted Cohen used to work in the music industry. He's a consultant there now. Ted, good to speak with you.
Good to be here.
First point, Mr. Cohen, I guess it's not really news that a record label's in trouble, is it?
Well, the news is, I think, the acceleration of the decline of the physical business. So I think the companies out there, the music companies, Warner among them, are being more proactive than they've been in having a dialogue with new digital companies, services, and products that want to license music content.
One of the other things they're doing, we learned this morning, is moving into merchandising and touring ticket sales. Do you think that's going to do it? Will that model work for them?
Well, I wasn't part of the deal, so I won't take credit for it, but 4 years ago, or 5 years ago now, we did such a deal with Robbie Williams, who is outside of the U.S., one of the biggest artists in the world. We did a deal with him, what I would refer to as a 360-degree deal. It was no longer being involved just in Robbie's CD sales, but being involved in his touring, in his merchandising, in all aspects of his career. I think what it does, in fact, I know what it does for the music companies, is it insures the bet. Because as we're living in a world now where most young music fans believe that music should be free, whether that's right or wrong, for a music company right now, if you're going to make a $1 million investment in a new artist, you really have a very unlikely chance of recouping that investment.
If you're a new artist, though, and you've been raised, in a manner of speaking, on digital music and easy access to consumers, what does a label offer you that you just can't get by putting yourself out there online?
I have to tell you, probably friends of mine will be surprised I'm going to say this, but labels offer you a lot. Everyone talks about the fact that the internet and mobile and all these digital environments have created a democratization and a lowering the bar for access for new artists to have the opportunity for exposure. And the most important thing to realize is all it's providing is the opportunity for exposure. It's not guaranteeing exposure. What a label, what a major label or a really strong indie brings to the table is the ability to get you noticed above that level playing field. How do you stand out, you know, when there's a million artists competing for attention? So the label provides marketing expertise, they provide promotion, they provide publicity.
So that new artist, then, he's sort of outsourcing all this work to the major labels, right? So they find the publicist, they do all the scut work.
Right. And what Warner has announced is a good approach because it's going to put them into all those various revenue streams. And as people decide, I like this artist, I want to sign up for their website, so the label probably has, you know, will have equity in the website. I want to buy a T-shirt. The label will see, you know, some type of revenue share on that T-shirt. Now they're on tour. I buy tickets. Again, that's another revenue stream. So these multiple revenue streams, at its most simplistic level, mitigate the risk.
Ted Cohen's a managing partner at Tag Strategic. It's a digital entertainment consulting shop. He used to be one of the suits at EMI. Ted, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
The push for biofuels is one of those win-lose things. We get more environmentally friendly ways to power our lives, but we have to pay more for the main ingredients of those fuels, corn or sometimes wheat. And it's not just us either. For centuries, Italians have been major consumers of a special kind of hard wheat that makes their pasta taste so good. Megan Williams reports now from Rome that those rising prices won't go down easy.
Troppo.
Too much. That's what Italian homemaker Gemma Zavolta says about the 20%+ price hike in pasta soon to hit Italy. Like millions of Italians, Zavolta's been feeding her family daily plates of steaming spaghetti, fettuccine, and linguine for decades now. It's cheap, healthy, and filling, she says. But for a food so common it's come to define Italian cuisine, such a big price hike will be tough to swallow. Homemakers aren't the only ones worried about the swelling pasta prices.
If the price move up 5% a week, you can imagine in a product like pasta that is made only with 100% durum wheat semolina, is a tragedy.
Mario Rumo is the beleaguered head of the Italian Pasta Association. the union that oversees the quality of pasta in Italy. He says not since 1973, when Israel went to war with Egypt and Syria, have costs risen so sharply. This time round, it's not war, but an onslaught of factors. New customers in North and South America looking to convert wheat for bioethanol. China and India eating more bread and less rice. And a bad wheat crop in Italy this spring. To make matters worse, Italy buys about 60% of its durum wheat. That's the hard semolina used to make its world-renowned pasta from Canada and Syria. Now Canada's predicting a poor harvest next month, and Syria's backing out of its contracts with Italy because other countries are offering to pay more.
It's easy on this particular moment to make a speculation. You know, durum wheat or cereals is a commodity product. It's like gold or like petrol, you know. Especially when there is a shortage, it's very easy to make speculation and make a lot of money.
Rumo says that while other countries have been willing to settle for lesser quality pasta made with a mix of slightly cheaper grains, Italians will stick with the costly durum wheat.
In fact, we have a law in Italy, its name is Purity Law, that said that pasta can be made in Italy only with durum wheat, because this is the wheat that produces the best result in terms of, you know, pleasure and quality.
Indeed, retired schoolteacher Marielle Cresci says even on her fixed pension, she wouldn't consider cooking anything but the best quality durum wheat pasta.
Surely, because it's better to cook, it's easier to cook. The taste is surely better than other pasta.
Rumo of the Pasta Association says it's important to keep things in perspective. 1 pound of pasta still costs less than a buck, a meal ticket that's tough to beat anywhere. In Rome, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we let you go today. Federal prosecutors scored a big win this morning in San Francisco. The former CEO of Brocade Communications was convicted in the first case of stock options backdating to go to trial. Greg Reyes faced decades in jail, millions of fines. Sentencing is now set for August 21st. There are, as of last check, more than 170 companies either under investigation by federal regulators or combing through their own books to sort out their options dates. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media, where we don't get stock options. Today, the Dow rose 35 points, a quarter of 1% on the Fed's decision to keep interest rates steady. The Nasdaq gained 14 points, half a percent. The S&P 500 lifted 9 points, 6-tenths of 1% there. Thanks to Miguel Macias and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. If you happen to miss something on the broadcast today, check our podcast. The link is on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Next time on the actual radio, building up Africa with American investment.
One of the challenges of our lifetime is to deal with this incredible disparity.
Rich U.S. loan guarantees for poor African startups. I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.